potential swearing-in ceremony for a new commander-in-chief. Lyndon B. Johnson was sworn in as president with his hand on a three-ring binder. The SecDef and vice chairman debate their approach with Moscow. Do they tell the Russian president that the American president is missing and presumed dead? SecDef, we should wait. Vice chairman, there's no time to wait. We tell Moscow now. SecDef, without a president, we look weak. Vice chairman, miscommunication comes with too great a risk. DISA, you're connected with Moscow. The vice chairman takes the call. She is greeted by a member of the Russian general staff. Vice chairman, we need to speak to your president immediately. We're under nuclear attack. We mean no harm to Russia. The Russian general responds. The Russian president is available for the president of the United States. Vice chairman repeats, the U.S. is under nuclear attack. It's like he didn't hear her. Russian general, da, which means yes. The vice chairman tells the officer of the general staff that Russia must refrain from any military action until the two nuclear-armed adversaries can get their two presidents on the phone. This is non-negotiable. She is firm. The officer says in Russian, Vosh prezident ozha dolzen bil nam pozvonit, which translates as, your president should have called us by now. And the line goes dead. 39 minutes. NATO headquarters, Brussels, Belgium. It is 9:42 p.m. local time at North Atlantic Treaty Organization headquarters on Boulevard Leopold III in Brussels, Belgium. Inside the glass-faceted building designed for the Belgian Ministry of Defense to represent interlocking fingers, NATO moves swiftly into action. The function of NATO is to further democratic values and peacefully resolve disputes. NATO's mission is to promote unity and cooperation, but NATO also promises lethal action if any one of its members is attacked. Now that the U.S. has been hit by nuclear weapons, NATO invokes Article 5, its provision that states an attack on one member is an attack on all members, that each member of the alliance will come to the aid of the attacked party and with nuclear force if necessary. NATO does not own nuclear weapons, but the U.S. keeps 100 nuclear bombs deployed on NATO bases in Europe. These 100 tactical nuclear weapons are part of a so-called nuclear sharing program between NATO and the United States. This means that U.S. nuclear equipment has been installed on jet aircraft fleets at 6 military bases in 5 NATO member countries. Each country's air force is assigned to carry out NATO strikes using U.S.-owned nuclear bombs kept on each base. But before any of these nuclear missions can occur, before any nuclear bombs can even come out of their WS-3 vaults and get loaded onto jets, NATO's nuclear planning group must receive authorization from the President of the United States. According to the NATO press office, the UK Prime Minister must also authorize this action. But no one knows where the US President is, or if he is even alive. Cars squeal down Boulevard Leopold III. Local leaders are deposited at NATO headquarters, front gates, and run inside. They hurry into the headquarters conference hall, where the nuclear planning group members assemble on electronic teleconference on a massive television-style screen. NATO translators speaking more than a dozen different languages place headphones over their ears, listen, and wait. Every member of the NATO nuclear planning group waits for word from or of the American president. And while they wait, air crews at six air bases across Europe receive emergency action messages to prepare for war. At bases in Belgium, Netherlands, Germany, Italy at two bases, Turkey. All airmen and soldiers at each of these bases gets ready for combat, each base already at DEFCON 1. Pilots and crews rush into hardened aircraft shelters, concrete, igloo-type structures that are able to sustain a hit from a 500-pound bomb, and where nuclear-capable bomber aircraft are kept. Everyone is now waiting on word from the chain of command. 39 minutes. National Defense Management Center, Moscow, Russia. Inside the war room at the National Defense Management Center in central Moscow, members of the Russian General Staff focus on video screens. They are watching real-time actions at NATO bases across Europe, thanks to a network of surveillance systems and other assets in place. In Belgium, in the Netherlands, in Germany, in Italy, and in Turkey, NATO bases equipped with nuclear-capable jet fighters idle on runways awaiting orders. From the Russian point of view, this movement, and there is lots of it, sets off a series of cascading alarms. Using signals intelligence intercepted from NATO communication systems and algorithms run by the supercomputer in the basement of the National Defense Management Center, Russian analysts interpret what they believe is happening in nearby Europe. Their conclusion is that NATO is preparing nuclear strikes. Russia considers NATO a primary adversary. For decades during the Cold War, Russia had its own alliance, the Warsaw Pact, aimed at countering NATO and the West. Newly declassified documents show that the Warsaw Pact countries, Albania, Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia, East Germany, Hungary, Poland, Romania, maintained their own nuclear attack strategy against the West for decades. This, despite Russia still claiming today not to have had a launch-on-warning policy during Soviet times. Despite intense animosity and name-calling over the decades, NATO and the Warsaw Pact countries never engaged in direct military conflict. There was posturing and skirmishing, but no live-fire battles. When the Soviet Union dissolved in December 1991, the Warsaw Pact ceased to exist. And then, one by one, lands formerly controlled by Russia began shifting their allegiance to the West. For many in Russia, it was a slap in the face. By 2014, the Russian Federation officially reinstated its anti-NATO position. The expansion of NATO into Russia's old neighborhood was undermining global stability and violating the balance of power in the nuclear missile sphere, official Russian military doctrine declared. Now, in this scenario, generals inside the Russian National Defense Management Center watch activity swirl around nuclear-capable jet fighters at air bases including Aviano in Italy and Kleinbrogel Air Base in Belgium. These NATO bases are considered within striking distance of Moscow, some 1,300 miles away, roughly the same distance as from Boston to Miami. Inside the war room at the National Defense Management Center in Moscow, contingency plans come to the fore. The missile attack early warning information from Tundra satellites, confirmed by Serpukhov 15, has activated the Kazbek communication system. Pavel Podvig tells us that this kind of early warning notification confirmation would initiate a nuclear high alert status known as preliminary command. Once this is done, Podvig clarifies, everyone waits, and they wait. They wait until they actually have an actual instruction to launch. The Russian generals begin sharing their opinions about what is happening in the United States and what should happen next. The future of Europe hangs in the balance. The consequences of a nuclear conflict between Russia and NATO are cataclysmic. A 2020 computer simulation by nuclear weapons scholars with Princeton University's Program on Science and Global Security found that a nuclear exchange between Russia and NATO would almost certainly escalate quickly, leading to the death and injury of nearly 100 million people in the first few hours. The Russian generals talk among themselves. They prepare what they are going to say to the Russian president. 40 minutes, Cheyenne Mountain Complex, Colorado. The U.S. military has fired 82 nuclear warheads at North Korea with the goal of decapitating the country's leadership before it launches any more nuclear strikes against the United States. This action is based on military doctrine called restoring deterrence. Nuclear war is not supposed to happen. Deterrence is supposed to hold. But if it doesn't, restoring deterrence is what happens next. Changing an adversary's decision calculus regarding further nuclear escalation is how a 2020 White House briefing document described it. In the words of STRATCOM Commander Admiral Charles A. Richard 2 years later, deterrence day-to-day is different from deterrence in crisis. It's different from deterrence in conflict. It's different from deterrence after first nuclear use, when you're attempting to restore deterrence. Restoring deterrence after first nuclear use in this scenario involves STRATCOM using overwhelming nuclear force in an effort to pressure the attacker to capitulate, to render them incapable of further attack, to change their decision calculus. But will it succeed? According to the U.S. Army, this task, on a scale of military hardship, ranges from difficult to impossible. North Korea's supreme leader has almost certainly disappeared into one of the nation's many underground facilities, into a deeply buried bunker system, a labyrinth of tunnels and command centers that has been carefully engineered over decades to hide the leadership before, during, and after a nuclear war. North Korea is known to have an extensive network of tunnels and underground facilities used for suspicious purposes, says the Army through a spokesman, including infiltrating the South, protecting the reclusive regime, and conducting nuclear tests. Using defector accounts, the South Korean military has mapped out some of the North's underground system and believes as many as 8,000 bomb-proof bunkers presently exist. But because Western intelligence assets in North Korea are rare, the U.S. remains mostly blind to the details. It is one of the hardest, if not the hardest, collection nation that we have to collect against, Director of National Intelligence Daniel Coats told Congress in 2017. We do not have consistent ISR, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, capabilities. There are gaps. The North Koreans know about these. And as Bruce Blair wrote in 2018, the possibility of intelligence gaps and hidden North Korean nuclear weapons and command bunkers would vex the U.S. in any future warfighting campaign. This includes where the North Korean leader might go to hide after launching a preemptive salvo in a nuclear war. To stop North Korea from launching more missiles, STRATCOM must destroy North Korea's leadership and its nuclear command and control. This poses an even more challenging problem, according to intelligence analysts in Washington think tanks. The country is run by a small group of loyalists called the Personal Secretariat, a majority of whom remain with the leader at all times. This unusual cadre of men and women includes his political and military advisors, but also his bodyguards, bankers, assistants, even his children's nannies. Michael Madden, director of the North Korea Leadership Watch at the Stimson Center, explains. The Personal Secretariat manages everything, his schedule, his haircuts, what he wears, his billions of U.S. dollars in foreign bank accounts. One unit assassinates people, another issues military commands, and another has command and control over all of North Korea's security and military forces, including its nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction. How to target a group of people holding the reins of power when almost nothing is known about who they are and even less about where they are? North Korea doesn't produce public reports. They have no independent newspapers or magazines. Most intelligence community information comes from satellite images and defector reports, which means the first 32 submarine-launched nuclear warheads will strike counterforce targets to include North Korea's nuclear launch facilities, North Korea's nuclear command and control facilities, North Korea's nuclear weapons production facilities. In its attempt to decapitate North Korea's leadership, the Defense Department will have to kill millions or tens of millions of North Korean civilians. Some argue this violates the United Nations Charter as well as the jus ad bellum principles of international law, that it violates the two fundamental principles of humanity and military necessity, including three long-standing requirements regarding distinction, proportionality, and avoidance of unnecessary suffering. But as humans around the world are collectively about to learn, the first rule of nuclear war is that there are no rules. The Defense Department's logic in destroying the North Korean capital city of Pyongyang, as well as large swaths of the countryside, is that it will put an end to one decision-maker's madness. The presumption here is that killing millions of North Koreans with a barrage of nuclear warheads offers the best chance of stopping North Korea's leader from killing millions more Americans. That killing more people can prevent killing more people. That it can restore deterrence. But will it? 40 minutes, 30 seconds. Haejeong-ni Underground Facility, Hwapyeong County, North Korea. In an isolated mountain valley in northern North Korea, roughly 20 miles from the border with China. A heavy steel door in the side of a mountain swings open wide. This is the clandestine Heijong-ni missile operating base, which includes a secret city underground. From decades of archival satellite imagery, the CIA has determined there to be more than 20 above-ground structures here, including a greenhouse to grow food and a lawn for a parade. That the complex includes at least two underground facilities and can house at least one regiment-sized missile unit, exact numbers unknown. The mountaintop here is covered with soil and has mature vegetation growing tall, designed to disguise itself from satellite detection overhead, imagery analyst Joseph Bermudez Jr. explains. But almost nothing is known about what goes on inside the facility. North Korea has never acknowledged its existence, and its national designator is not known. Seconds after the steel door in the side of the mountain swings open, out rolls a Korean People's Army ballistic missile transporter erector launcher with a Hwasong-17 ICBM lying horizontal on its 22-wheeled flatbed. The launcher drives several hundred feet down a dirt mountain road lined with a protective berm. The vehicle stops. Soldiers jump out, make adjustments, step to the side. The missile is armed. It is readied. It fires. In a plume of explosive rocket exhaust, the Hwasong-17 ICBM ascends from its launch pad and into the sky, moving above the wooded forest in boost phase. Its flames ignite the pine trees on the ground and send large boulders rolling downhill. The total number of North Korean nuclear bombs targeting the United States in this scenario has now risen to 3. Thousands of miles overhead, the Defense Department's mighty SBIRS satellite system sees the launch from space and notifies command. The likely targets for this second ICBM will take another several minutes to discern. With the Pentagon destroyed, track data flows to NORAD, NORTHCOM, and STRATCOM via the command center in the sky, the Doomsday Plane, to Site R beneath Raven Rock Mountain, and to the two nuclear command centers that remain, the Missile Warning Center in the Cheyenne Mountain Complex, Colorado, the Global Operations Center below Offutt Air Force Base, Nebraska. 40 minutes, 30 seconds. National Defense Management Center, Moscow, Russia. Watching satellite TV inside his Moscow office, a colonel with Russia's main intelligence directorate, the GRU, is so enthralled with the mayhem in America that he neglects checking his voicemail. He has not heard the message that came in 15 minutes ago from a source he runs in Wyoming, USA. The job of the GRU is to gather human intelligence for the Russian military through military attachés, foreign agents, and spies. This includes spies in America, like the old man who keeps an eye on the Echo 01 Minuteman III ICBM launch facility in Wyoming. In Moscow, the GRU officer checks his voicemail. He listens to a short, numerically coded message, one that follows previously authorized reporting protocols. The message includes numbers and letters in the Russian alphabet, in Cyrillic, that verify content and authenticity. Translated into English, the message is succinct. The ICBMs have launched. Phone in hand, the GRU officer picks up a secure telephone and begins making calls. 40 minutes, 30 seconds. Hudson Yards, New York City. In New York City, at the Cable News Network studio in Hudson Yards, workers continue to flee the building in droves, including the anchor who, until just a few minutes ago, was reporting breaking news live on air. In this scenario, a younger journalist now sits down in front of the camera. Working to keep her composure, she explains to whoever may be watching that access to social media platforms across much of the country is mostly down, that the ability for viewers to watch this CNN broadcast is likely hit or miss, depending on where it is you live. Many American TV and radio stations are not functioning, the result of data center failures, carrier failures, and workers straight up abandoning their jobs. With information sharing in a state of utter chaos, the journalist says she will now read out loud instructions downloaded from FEMA's Region 4 office in Atlanta, which is still functioning at this time. Journalist, I'm going to read from Be Prepared for a Nuclear Explosion. Behind her, an electronic screen displays an image screen-grabbed from the California Department of Public Health. The terrifying photograph is a decades-old image of an actual nuclear mushroom cloud and stem. The photograph is real, a nuclear bomb captured on film during a Cold War bomb test back when atmospheric nuclear testing was legal. The image has been touched up. Someone has added orange and red hues. It looks sinister and malevolent because it is. Journalist, people are supposed to get inside, and stay tuned, according to the federal government. Reading from FEMA's website, the young journalist gets interrupted by a colleague who hands her an official federal tome, a highlighted copy of a 135-page guidebook developed by the Executive Office of the President titled Planning Guidance for Response to a Nuclear Detonation. Journalist, FEMA and the Office of the President say this is what people should expect from a 10-kiloton nuclear detonation in their city or town. She has no way of knowing the bomb that just struck Washington, D.C. was 1 megaton, which is 100 times the yield. Skimming over the document, she reads aloud, humans incinerated, blast, thermal and radiation injuries, beta burns to the skin, lethal radiation doses 20 miles from ground zero, even with medical care, not expected to survive, blast an electromagnetic pulse will damage communications infrastructure, stalling of vehicles, infrastructure completely destroyed, communications equipment, cell towers, etc., destroyed. Computer equipment, destroyed. Control systems, destroyed. Water and electrical systems, destroyed. Few, if any, buildings, structurally sound. Rubble in streets, rubble 30 feet deep. Blast injuries, overshadowed by injuries from collapsing structures. Blast injuries from flying debris and glass. Unstable structures, sharp metal objects, ruptured gas lines. Hazmat teams thwarted by stalled and crashed automobiles, downed utility lines, overturned automobiles completely block streets, raging firestorms beyond the abilities of firefighters to control, hazardous chemicals, medical triage, contamination from fallout, widespread death. And then, the journalist comes upon a line so jarring, it causes her to stop reading and to shake her head in disbelief. She takes a breath and reads on. After a nuclear detonation, priorities are likely to change. Her cell phone pings. FEMA has issued another wireless emergency alert. She reads aloud. U.S. under nuclear attack. Seek shelter below ground. Evacuation may be necessary to avoid fire risks. Turning back to the camera, she starts to say something but then stops. She loses her composure on screen. Journalist, what in hell? She asks aloud, to no one in particular and everyone all at once. Are we supposed to stay where we are or evacuate? She holds her smartphone up to the camera and points. Journalist, these two sets of instructions from FEMA contradict one another. She stops speaking. What is there to say? 40 minutes, 30 seconds. Los Osos, California. In the California beach community of Los Osos, a little over 6 miles north of Diablo Canyon, residents are in a state of absolute terror. The tall, rugged peaks between the nuclear power station and the town shielded many local residents from getting third-degree burns or carbonizing limbs. It protected them from getting impaled by flying objects or being crushed to death under buildings mowed down by blast wave. But geography can't spare anyone in the area from an excruciating death by radiation that is inevitable and will soon follow. If the radiation spewing out of the exposed reactor cores at the power plant doesn't kill them soon, the fallout from a mushroom cloud seeded with shattered spent fuel rods surely will. Pocket dosimeters and ion chamber electroscopes carried by some area residents to monitor accumulated radiation doses in emergency situations have maxed out. These field-readable dosimeters are designed to aid in tactical decisions after an unforeseen radiological release. Residents of Los Osos who are prepared enough to be in possession of one of these dosimeters collectively realize the dire situation at hand. If they don't leave the area immediately, they will die. The power is out. Television and FM radio not available anywhere in the area. Even the NOAA Weather Radio All Hazards Nationwide Network, long considered a stalwart news source in a disaster, has collapsed from overload with an eerie, unknown warning, unknown statement, error code, broadcasting in a loop. Boats at sea tuned to Channel 16, the VHF frequency for communication with other boats and the U.S. Coast Guard, but hear only indiscernible sounds. The nuclear reactor oversight telephone line is down. Pacific Gas and Electric, which runs the power plant, has a troubling safety history that includes a $13.5 billion settlement of claims linked to California fires. The tragic irony here is that this catastrophe is not their fault. Cell phones and computers that were plugged into wall sockets when the bomb exploded have had their microprocessors destroyed. The battery-powered emergency sirens are, for the most part, functioning as designed. Pole-mounted horns screech ear-piercing wails, an ominous, steady, 3 to 5 minute long siren that sounds without interruption. A warning many residents know to mean nuclear emergency. Beyond the local beach towns, some 500,000 people reside within 50 miles of Diablo Canyon. Word spreads rapidly among residents here that across the country, Washington, D.C., is also under nuclear attack, that what is happening is not a localized nuclear accident, but nuclear war. In coastal communities across San Luis Obispo County, cars back up out of driveways, windows up, noses and mouths covered with pieces of clothing or masks they had left over from COVID times. It is 12:43 p.m. local time. Everyone's kids are still in school. Every second matters. The only way to stay alive is to evacuate. But which way to go? Fallout moves with wind. Beyond residents' driveways, a new horror presents itself in every town, at every turn, in every small and large community along the central California coast. Cars, cars everywhere, separating the Diablo Canyon power plant from most towns is a 1,800-foot-tall peak known as Mount Bouchon. This hilly range of earth and stone buffered much of the bomb's localized electromagnetic pulse effects, sparing many cars from having their microprocessors fried. But the streetlights are out. Traffic is in a snarl. Residents in existential panic drive their cars over berms and across lawns in violent, desperate attempts at escape. Vehicles race down the wrong sides of the roads, smashing into other vehicles like bumper cars. It is bumper to bumper everywhere. 18 minutes have passed since the Diablo Canyon power plant was hit by a 300-kiloton nuclear bomb. A radioactive forest fire has set the surrounding mountains on fire, a mega inferno tearing its way down Mount Bouchon on all sides, threatening people and entire towns. Radioactive ash fills the air, marble-sized pieces of pulverized nuclear reactor concrete rain down from above. Dead seagulls fall from the sky, their wings on fire. People begin to lose control of their bowels, start vomiting blood. As the mushroom cloud rises, the sky goes dark. Every second matters. People get out of their cars and begin running. 40 minutes, 30 seconds. Undisclosed location. 700 miles above the Pacific Ocean. High above the Pacific Ocean, 8 Trident missiles arc over the Earth, traveling at 13,600 miles per hour, or Mach 18. Their flight began just minutes ago, from an undisclosed point in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, somewhere north of the island of Tinian. Their targets are in Pyongyang. The total distance to target is 1,800 miles. With a range angle of 38.26 degrees, the total travel time from launch to target is 14 minutes. Missile expert Ted Postal did the math. Guiding the Tridents on their high-speed transit through the atmosphere is an unusual form of navigation in the modern era. The U.S. Navy's most powerful, most expensive, most accurate nuclear-armed missiles get where they are going by an astro-navigation technique invented specifically for the Trident missile system, star sighting. Long before humans figured out how to write language down, how to record their own histories into stone and clay, people figured out how to get from point A to point B with the help of the heavens. Celestial navigation involves the practice of fixing an object's position using the stars, the sun, and other celestial bodies. The submerged submarine has no ability to know exactly where it is at the time of launch. Trident Missile Guidance Systems Manager Stephen J. DiTullio explains. There's a shipboard navigator, a human, to assist, but even that isn't precise enough. The solve to usher in Armageddon, DiTullio says, is in the stars. The way that we handle geolocation uncertainty is by taking a star sighting during missile flight to then effectively correct for the initial position error. Conceptually, this is the same system that has been used since the early days of the Cold War. The primitive technology prevents hacking. For this same reason, there is no remotely controlled kill switch on a ballistic missile. If there were, an enemy could ostensibly hack into a ballistic missile's guidance system and assume control of it. 8 Trident missiles, each with enough combined explosive power to turn Pyongyang into a fireplace, continue on course, on a suborbital trajectory, guided by the stars. 41 minutes. Central Command Center, Komsomolsk-on-Amur, Russia. Russia's eastern counterpart to the Serpukhov 15 early warning radar facility is a central command center without a known Western reporting name. Located near Komsomolsk-on-Amur in the Russian Far East, the facility sits on the banks of the Amur River, along an unnamed road, in Khabarov's Krai. This location is roughly 175 miles from the border with China and 600 miles from the border with North Korea. The facility's purpose is to interpret information from Tundra's constellation of early warning satellites in space, to see attacking nuclear missiles that are coming in from the United States by way of the Pacific Ocean to the south. Launched as they would be from a U.S. Ohio-class nuclear-powered, nuclear-armed submarine. Komsomolsk-on-Amur is a backwater city, isolated from the modern world, a regional center of metallurgy, aircraft manufacturing, and shipbuilding. It is also the former home to a notorious over-the-horizon radar transmitter facility called Duga 2, but more famously known as Woodpecker. The radar system was named as such for the mysterious and repetitive tapping noise it transmitted over shortwave radio bands around the world for more than a decade during the Cold War. The steel and wire Duga structure was a massive, half-mile-long and 500-foot-tall monolith. NATO military intelligence monitored the site obsessively and gave it the reporting name Steel Yard. The Duga transmitter in Komsomolsk-on-Amur was dismantled in the 1990s after the Soviet Union was dissolved, but its more notorious counterpart still stands in Ukraine inside the Chernobyl exclusion zone. At 5:44 a.m. local time, the commander here at Komsomolsk-on-Amur is waiting for additional incoming information from Tundra space satellites. Across the Russian military, the Kazbek communication system has been activated. Every military facility in the country is on the highest alert status on so-called preliminary command. Just seconds ago, Komsomolsk-on-Amur received word from its sister stations in Barnaul and in Irkutsk. The Russian Aerospace Force has 4 types of ground-based early warning radars potentially capable of detecting ballistic missile salvos, Dr. Thomas Withington tells us. An electronic warfare expert and military radar analyst with the Royal United Services Institute in England, Withington calculated how Russian track data in this scenario might come in. 3 minutes and 9 seconds after the Trident's launched, the 77YA6DM Voronezh DM radar system in Barnaul began tracking the submarine-launched ballistic missile salvo. 50 seconds later, the 77YA6VP Voronezh DP in Irkutsk began tracking it too. And now, Komsomolsk on Amur gets alerted by the Tundra satellite system of an incoming missile attack from the Pacific. Early warning space satellites see hundreds of objects coming at Russia, or what the commander thinks is at Russia, from the south. The same salvo seen by Russian ground radar stations in Barnaul and Irkutsk. The Tundra system sees hundreds of objects at this point in time, not because Tundra is misperceiving sunlight or clouds for rocket exhaust. Rocket exhaust only happens in a ballistic missile's boost phase. The Tridents are now in mid-course phase, where a new misperception by Russian early warning radar systems can occur. Trident missiles contain hundreds of objects inside every warhead bus. These objects are decoys designed to fake out Russian interceptor missiles. These decoys are constructed from thin pieces of crossed wire and shaped like Jax, the kids' toys, Ted Postal explains, and to a radar system like the one at Komsomolsk on Amur. These wires look like hundreds of additional warheads. The commander picks up the phone and notifies Moscow that his early warning system sees a massive barrage of warheads attacking Russia from the south. 41:01 inside the Doomsday plane over North Dakota, USA. Inside the airborne command center in the Doomsday plane, the STRATCOM commander opens the black book. With a third attacking ballistic missile on its way to the United States, additional nuclear counterstrikes against North Korea are under his review. The Secretary of Defense and the Vice Chairman are also on the call on advanced, extremely high-frequency satellite comms from Site R. It has been 8 minutes since DISA lost contact with Marine One. No one knows where the president is. The Quick Reaction Force has located the football and is bringing it back to Raven Rock. The mill aide is dead, his parachute ripped apart by blast wave. The special agent in charge of the president's detail, the CAT operators, and the president are all still missing, presumably separated from one another by wind drift. With the chairman of the Joint Chiefs dead, the vice chairman is now the highest-ranking officer in the military, whose job it is to advise the president and the Secretary of Defense. As acting chairman, she outranks all other officers in the military, but she cannot command the military. That is the job of the president. Vice chairman, SecDef needs to be sworn in as acting president now. Everyone on satellite comms agrees. But executive branch people at Site R are fighting over line of succession protocols from Article 2, Section 1, Clause 4 of the Constitution. At issue is the still unresolved post-9/11 piece of congressional legislation about what to do after a mass decapitation event. The president pro tempore of the Senate is, in this scenario, apparently still alive. DISA received a message from one of his staffers just a few minutes ago. The second highest ranking member of the Senate was homesick when the bomb detonated over the Pentagon, and now he's on his way to Site R, driving himself from Maryland in his own car to assume his line of succession role as commander-in-chief. National Security Advisor. Forget that. We invoke the bumping procedure and swear in SecDef. He cites Title 3, Section 19 of the Succession Act of 1947. People's Choice. Stratcom has a different focus. Stratcom Commander, we need to respond in force to incoming missile number 3. Vice Chairman, SecDef needs to be sworn in as acting president now. Stratcom Commander, we need to choose strike options. SecDef, we can't do anything until we have the Russian president on the line. Everyone on the satellite call knows the Stratcom Commander is in possession of the universal unlock code, meaning he has the ability, and arguably the authority, to launch additional nuclear counterstrikes. Stratcom Commander, the Russian president refusing your call is not good. SecDef, upset. He won't take my call because I'm not the acting president of the United States. Vice Chairman, we need to swear in SecDef. SecDef, I'm blind. As rapid-fire discussions ensue, and as decisions are being made about what looks strong and what looks weak, so are they being made in Russia, in a nuclear bunker underground. 42 Minutes, Boyds, Maryland. No one has heard from the president because when the nuclear bomb hit the Pentagon, Marine One experienced a system failure from localized electromagnetic pulse and crashed into the ground. As we know, seconds before the crash, a member of the Secret Service CAT element tandem-jumped the president out the open door of the Sikorsky in an attempt to save his life. The two men landed violently in a forested area in Boyds, Maryland, near Little Seneca Lake. The CAT operator had his neck broken. The president was cushioned by the CAT operator's body and kept alive by a stroke of luck. Now the president unclips himself from the dead man's body and wriggles free. There's a deep gash on his forehead. His left arm and right leg have compound fractures. He can see the bloody, torn tendons and the gray-white exposed bone pushing through his skin. There is blood, lots of blood. The president lies here in this wooded area, listening to the trees sway in the early spring wind. He is terrified that he will die. He is helpless. He can't walk or even crawl out of here, not with the damage to his arm and leg. He is losing blood fast. He feels faint. He is the commander-in-chief, and America is at nuclear war. Will anyone find him? The president's iPhone got lost in the mayhem. He tries using the dead CAT operator's radio, but it doesn't work. He is unsure where he physically is. There's a quick reaction force looking for him, he surmises, but without any communication devices working, how will they find him before he bleeds out? 42 Minutes, Ground Zero, the National Zoo. In the rings around Ground Zero in Washington, D.C., the horrific pain and suffering is not limited to humans. At the National Zoo, 4 miles north of the Pentagon, a majority of the animals are dead, but some are still alive, blinded, with third-degree burns, and in a complete state of shock. Asian elephants, Western lowland gorillas, and Sumatran tigers writhe and bellow in their cages and their pens. Most have charred skin hanging off their bodies, their hair on fire. Animals instinctively go to water when on fire in a futile attempt to put out the flames. This includes humans whose bodies now fill the waterways all across the city. The Potomac is clogged with untold numbers of dead, similar to what happened in Nagasaki, Japan, in August 1945. Thousands of bodies bopped up and down in the river, bloated and purplish from soaking up the water. survivor Shigeko Matsumoto later recalled. Here in the waterways around D.C., large metallic-colored blowflies, carrion insects, land on the floating dead bodies and begin laying eggs. The animals in their cages will all almost certainly die. There is no one left to feed them or to free them, to let them try and survive on their own. Any human survivors near the National Zoo face insurmountable hurdles. Burned and bleeding, their lungs filled with toxic gases and smoke, they are desperately trying to leave the disaster area before the ensuing megafire burns them alive. But massive piles of rubble make the terrain near impossible to traverse. Unsound buildings collapse all around. Lethal radiation in the air silently sentences survivors to death. History lesson number 8, radiation sickness. Defense scientists have known what acute radiation sickness does to the body since the Manhattan Project years. Consider the May 1946 accident at Omega Site. At a secret laboratory hidden in the Los Alamos woods, the details of which remained classified for decades. It was a cool spring day, 3 miles from the main lab, when a group of scientists stood hovering over a table, concentrating. The men were working on a plutonium bomb core, the first atomic test since Hiroshima and Nagasaki were destroyed. The U.S. nuclear stockpile at the time was around 4. The future of the nuclear arms race depended on this moment. The Los Alamos scientists, upon whom many jobs and fortunes depended, were under great pressure to get this plutonium core experiment correct. The physicist handling the plutonium that day was a man named Louis Slotin. There were 7 other scientists in the room. Slotin had recently decided to leave the Manhattan Project for moral reasons, he told friends. The war was over, and he was done working on atomic bombs. Los Alamos officials said fine, but required Slotin to train someone to take his place. That someone was a scientist named Alvin C. Graves. During this dangerous experiment, dangerous enough to be known as tickling the dragon's tail, Slotin dropped one of the nuclear spheres he was handling, causing the material to go critical. Knowing the risk to himself, but hoping to save the others in the room, Slotin thrust himself in front of Alvin Graves, who was standing beside him. Eyewitnesses described a quick flash of blue light, a blue glow, others said, and a wave of intense heat. People began screaming. The security guard assigned to protect the nuclear material fled the room, raced outside, and ran up into the New Mexico hills. Someone called for an ambulance to come quick. The laboratory was evacuated, but Louis Slotin stayed behind to begin sketching out a diagram where he and everyone else had been standing for future study and use, so defense scientists could understand how radiation poisoning works, how it kills. Slotin's sketch was remarkably detailed for a man whose death by acute radiation syndrome had already begun. Years later, the laboratory made a mock-up of where Louis Slotin was when the accident happened. He was just 35 years old. In the ambulance, Slotin vomited. His left hand, the one closest to the nuclear material when the accident happened, went numb. His groin began swelling. He had explosive diarrhea and vomited again and again. At the Los Alamos hospital, more vomiting, more watery diarrhea releasing from his bowels. Prostrate and weak, watery fluid began collecting in his hands, which expanded like balloons. Horrible and painful blisters formed under his skin, then burst. Doctors dressed